Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. The name calla lily comes from a Greek word for beauty. At some point during the 19th century, flowers began to be associated with the expression of specific feelings, and the stunning cone-shaped calla lily became the symbol of youth and rebirth. You will often find it in arrangements that are sent for major transitions, such as births and new beginnings. It is also the symbol of the latest wine venture for fourth-generation winemaker Carrie Gott. On this episode of Exploring the Wine Glass, I sit down with Carrie and learn all about Pope Valley, calla lily, and his hand-holding get you into the wine industry business. While you're listening, please scroll down and rate us as well as leaving us a review. In just over 2 years, I have amazingly almost 21,000 downloads, and your reviews are what helps other people to find me. I would love to read your review on the next podcast. Sláinte. So, hey, everybody, welcome to this episode of Dracaena Wines on Wine. And if you listen to the podcast, you know that this is when I sit down with somebody in the wine industry and basically get them to share their story with you so that you can hear their passion about wine. And although this is the first time I'm seeing Carrie face to face, I haven't officially met him, which I hope that will change in the future when I get north. But I know he has amazing passion for wine because I've heard him talk in other situations. Plus, you know, when I do these interviews, I have to do some little stalking on the internet. So I get to find out things that, you know, when you Google somebody's name, you get a lot of stuff. So first of all, welcome, Carrie.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And for those of you who do not know who I'm talking about, this is Carrie Gott. And he is, I don't even really know how to describe what you do because you are involved in so much. But what brought me to you to start off with is calla lily wines. So you are into a lot of stuff, and we're going to get into all of that. But first and foremost, I want to talk to you about the wines that were sent to me because holy cow, they blew my mind. They were so, so incredible. The first one was the 2014 calla lily ultimate cabernet sauvignon. So you want to give a little story about that wine, your thoughts on that wine?
Well, another great vintage in Napa Valley, you know, the great growing season. I like to describe wines by how they are angular or soft curves. That was a vintage that they're big, full wines, a lot of flavor, a lot of texture, but weren't real angular. And so our typical method there in the winery is very straightforward winemaking. Pick the grapes at a nice ripe maturity flavor. We look at the numbers, but we're really looking for the maturity of the flavors. 3-day cold soak. I ferment with a blend of yeast just to make sure that the wine goes dry. And when we get to just about the end of fermentation or maybe one day after fermentation is over, we press. I'm not interested in extracting every last bit of tannin, and the color's all out, but not every last bit of tannin, I don't think, for the area where we grow those grapes really is the way. So then it instantly goes into about 50% new French oak barrels, a mix of various coopers that I've used over the years, and is aged all the way up until late August, such as on Tuesday, this next week, we bottled the 2017 Ultimate Cabernet. So it's been in barrel about 20 months. And right now the vineyard is fully through, for this year, fully through veraison. and the sugar probably is 17. We haven't bothered to do sugar in the vineyards yet. Vineyards are very healthy. Nice. We're having some nice warm weather here, but no blasts of heat. So the 14 shows another good crop. It wasn't a huge crop at Calla Lily. We probably get 2.8 or maybe 3 tons per acre, which I'd like to keep it down at that level. Big, healthy vineyards, hillside vineyard. All of our vineyards are hillside. And we're literally just a couple feet below the border of Howell Mountain. We're not Howell Mountain, we're Poe Valley, but we're right up against the edge. So the 13 was a little bit softer wines, the 14 a little bit rounder. The 15 very supple wines. I mean, I can go through each of the vintages, but for Calla Lily, we're very consistent in the style that we make. It's a great vineyard, and we have all 5 classic Bordeaux varietals. So if we took the whole vineyard, crushed it all, just blended it all together, we would still have a wine that was slightly more than 75% Cabernet, but it would also have Malbec, Merlot, Cab Franc, and Petit Verdot in the mix. So usually, and I don't have the numbers of the 14 in front of it, usually it is our Cabernet is a blend of the Cabernet that we grow, hillside, Merlot, Cab Franc, and then as needed, a little bit of Malbec or a little bit of Petit Verdot, depending on, and I work with an assistant winemaker, Kelly Diani, how we decide the blend goes together, because we're not fixed on, we're blending the wine for a style that is Calla Lily style.
Awesome. So I have it, which I could be completely wrong. I have it as 83% Cabernet Sauvignon, 9% of my beloved Cabernet Franc, and 8% Merlot.
And you know more than I do right now because you're reading
it. I'm reading it. And I have to tell you, when I brought it up to my nose to smell it, like, when you do the WSET stuff, they're like, oh, is it light? Is it medium? Is it medium plus? Is it pronounced? I brought this up and I didn't even have to get it to my nose. And the aromas were like, wow, right? And it was leather, black cherry, cola, and just a beautiful, you can tell I like this wine, huh? Just beautiful little bit of spice right there. And I was like, oh, you know, these aromas are so nice. I don't know if I want to taste it because, like, oh, I just want to keep sniffing. But then when I tasted it, it was incredible. And shortbread, like, that was what I was like, shortbread and plum and raspberry and then anise, which I love in a wine, and leather. Like, I could have gone writing for hours about this wine.
And the wine is still really young.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. But as you said, you're not looking to pull out all of that tannin that's in there. And I think that that's what makes it approachable now. And I am sad that I don't have another bottle because I would love to be able to taste it, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road, because there's so much structure in it that it's can sit and you can drink it later, but it, you know, so it's definitely age worthy, but there was something, the finesse that you have in that wine makes it approachable today.
And it was a great growing year. So thank you very much for the compliments. I mean, it's fun to make wine like that. And because the vineyard makes the wine, I just stand back and I'm the chef in the kitchen and just make sure it goes the right direction.
So. There you go. And then the second wine that was sent to me was the 2013 Audax Cabernet Sauvignon.
Right.
And that I have as 86.6% Cabernet Sauvignon, 13.2% Merlot, 0.2% Cab Franc. And that was in your face. That was a wine that stands up and says, you must pay attention to me, because incredible.
On the blending of that wine on Audax, and Audax, you know, is the base word for audacious. It's the tribute to the brave people that were the first people that came to Napa Valley to the vineyard and wine business, you know, way before the turn of the century in 1900. So Audax, beautiful word.
Yes.
We try to build bigger shoulders on the wine. So when Kelly and I blend, we always blend the Audax first.
Okay.
Because we have the whole, you know, we have the whole collection of, you know, we usually end up with like 12 to 14 different lots that we have of the wines before we do any blending. And we don't do any blending for like maybe 9 months after it's been in barrel and it's through malolactic. And the wines really start to show their personality. And then we can see, you know, you can sort of see the shoulders of the wine. And we're blending. It's not so much color because all of the Callalilly wines have very dark color. Or full color, but looking for a little bit more mass and style, and knowing that people are likely going to age the wine longer. So that's why it usually is higher in percentage of Cabernet Sauvignon than the Ultimate.
Okay. And I felt that this one had a little bit more acidity to it than the Ultimate. A little bit more acidity and a little bit more tannin. I wouldn't, like, again, it's not out in your face tannin, but I can see how this one it would last years. It's definitely age worthy.
Yeah, I mean, those are, we don't make a lot of Audax, and those are fun to take the very best lots. And you typically, it's from two sections of vineyard. One of them is a very interesting section of vineyard. It is actually Cabernet, very old clone. We don't even know what the clone is. But it's on AXR rootstock.
Oh.
The original rootstock that when I was a kid was planted everywhere in Napa Valley. So once after Prohibition and a lot of vineyards were replanted, either here in Napa Valley, you planted ARX1 or St. George. Those were the two rootstocks that you could use. And AXR then finally, Phylloxera type 2, finally wiped it all out. But we have about maybe a third of an acre of big old vines, and the trunks on the vines are just massive.
Wow.
Produce a small amount of fruit, clusters. The clusters are very small, and it is a late ripener. So usually the last block of grapes we pick at Callalilly are either the Petit Verdot or the AXR one rootstock Cabernet, and it is more silky and broad in your mouth. And then there's another block of Cabernet that we have that's on the other side of the winery, which is a clone 7 on 10114 rootstock, and it is much more broad in style. So we take this elegant bottom structure and we build shoulders on it, and then a little bit of Cab Franc, a little bit of Merlot, whatever works, and a little bit of Malbec. And whatever works in the blend to add the finesse. And, you know, what's neat is adding little pieces of the other varieties that definitely swing the wine in an elegant direction.
Absolutely. So the winemaking is science and art, but this Audax bottle was art in itself. I mean, it... Not to mention really, really heavy, but I don't know what you call the medallion, whatever, on the label. So
the medallion we apply, and it's got we designed the head that's on the medallion, and then the bottle is silk screen. And it's an artist that I really enjoy working with that has done a lot. She's done all of the Callalilly packaging. And, you know, she just went over the top on that one.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. We bottle it, and then we don't put any labels on the bottle, and then we got to come back months later and put the coin in the middle of the chest of the bottle or the crest of the bottle, and then another paper label that goes over the top of the bottle with the vintage on it. So packaging is complicated, but it's beautiful.
It certainly is. And how many, you said you don't produce a lot of that. About how many cases of that do you produce?
We would typically bottle 500 or 600 six bottle cases. So it's 250 to 312 bottle cases, but all of the wines are bottled in beautiful six bottle cases.
Okay. And so they're machine bottled, and then you hand put the medallion on and the label that reminds me of an international of the international topping.
Yeah, we do that. You know, we do that 6 months later. There's no rush because the wine's going nowhere. It's going to sit in the warehouse while it gets the first 2 or 2.5 years of aging before we even look at the wine, thinking about selling it.
So this, what I tasted was the 2013. That's your current vintage, your current release vintage of that one.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of hold back time. It's a lot of patience.
It needs it because we build it to age, you know, and that, you know, we're not rushed to get it out of the winery.
Right.
You know, we want it to show really well because we live in the day and age that people typically pull the cork and drink.
That is true. That is true. All right. So in addition to these wines, you also produce a Pinot Noir from Carneros, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and again, if you're going to make Pinot, it's Carneros is a great region to make it. What about the region about Carneros do you think makes Pinot the perfect grape for there?
Well, Pinot is an early ripener like Chardonnay. Carneros is much further down in Napa Valley, sitting at the top of the San Francisco Bay or San Pablo Bay. So it has a lot of bay influence. So the winds come in through the Golden Gate and go south towards San Jose or north towards the Carquinez Strait in the San Pablo Bay. So a typical morning, I'm sure down there this morning the fog and wind was till 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and then boom, it goes from, you know, 55 degrees to 75 or 80. They won't get as hot today here in St. Helena, which is another 25 miles north. We're close to 100 degrees today. Down there right now, it's probably 78 or 85, something like that. So why that works for Pinot Noir, being an early ripening variety, but it's being grown in a cooler area. So it may, if we're growing the Pinot Noir here in St. Helena, we'd probably be picking it now. But down there, there's not that many degree days of heat as compared to up here. So most of the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in Napa Valley is all down in Carneros where we have the cooler weather. And it just delays it. And as the days get shorter and, you know, the vines sense the difference in the amount of hours of sun that it has during the day, it just delays the ripening. So we did sugar samples in one of the vineyards down in Carneros today for another winery that I'm involved with. And we're sitting at like 18, 19, 20, something like that. So it's got a ways to go.
Yeah.
It won't move very fast. We have a couple warm days ahead, but no scorchers. So, and the vines are still getting a small amount of water. They're in very good shape, good canopy this year because of all the rain that we had in May. You know, in May we had like 9 inches of rain or something, which is kind of like, you know, sort of unheard of,
right.
Well, not unheard. It rains, but, you know, we could have sort of normally expect an inch of rain in May, and we got a lot, and the weather was cool. So that just delayed everything. And so the once June, we started to get some high heat again, and we had quite a lot of canopy growth, which we had to maintain and retuck canes and pull some leaves off and stuff. So it slowed everything down, and then we had some warm days in July and cool days in July. And, you know, it's just a normal year. Right now, I could say that, you know, we have a good-sized crop. It's probably not as big as last year's overall in the area, but we're just starting to see some flavors, and we have Sauvignon Blanc that maybe is around 20. Okay. That's up here in the northern part. Cabernet has got a long ways to go. So, you know, we're starting, and of course what we're doing right now is, you know, we're bottling wine as fast as we can everywhere, and we have the bottling at Calla Lily next Tuesday where we'll bottle the Ultimate and Audax, both 2017 wines.
Okay, awesome. And then I also heard through the grapevine that your Pinot is the by the glass at Copia.
Yeah, that's for like 6 months. Yeah, it's great. They love it.
That's incredible. Like, did you just walk into Copia and say, hey, you know, I want you to try this wine?
Because we have a very good friend that helps us with sales.
Okay.
And she knows the people at Copia, and she knows the general manager, and he fell in love with the wine because he loves Pinot Noir. So it works.
There you go. That's quite the thing, because, you know, I know personally, making the wine is kind of the easier part of it. It's the selling it, and to go into the restaurants and, you know, you go in and they're like, oh yeah, yeah. And then, but that's a kudos. Our wine just got accepted into, in New Jersey, Crystal Springs Resort, which is a grand award winning restaurant for like the last 14 years straight. And
wow, congratulations.
Yeah, like I left there and I was glad they didn't have didn't see cameras around me, because there was quite the little happy dance going on.
Oh, great.
All right, so I'm going to move away from wine for a little bit and a little bit more into you yourself. So you've been around wine pretty much your entire life. I've heard you say, or I read, that it's in your blood. So it started with your great-grandparents in Lodi, correct?
Correct. Fred and Daisy Carey, they grew grapes, and I actually have in my dressing room, my home just outside of town here, a painting done by Daisy Carey. Carey was the family name. I use it as my first name. Done in 1894, the varieties that they grew outside of the town of Lodi, and there was Tokay, Zinfandel, and Mission. And so the Tokays ship very well. The Missions ship very well. The Zinfandel a little bit more fragile, but there already was ice-cooled rail cars at that time in the late 1800s. And so the grapes would be boxed. They go into the rail cars, and then off to the East Coast, Chicago, Boston, wherever there was a lot of Italians. And so you used a little bit of the Tokay in the mix, and a little bit more of the Mission, which would then dilute the high sugar that came in with the Zinfandel. The Zinfandel would probably come in at 28 bricks. And, you know, for a home winemaker to try to get that to go dry,
not happening.
The Mission added another little bit of flavor, and the Tokays were planted there. Sometimes you more want to think that they were table grapes, but where that industry really ended up was the Tokays were perfect for making brandy. And so in Lodi, the industry for distilled spirits really turned to Tokays. And Tokay, you know, it's a huge bunch. You know, every bunch weighs like 2 pounds and, you know, not very high sugar. And you ferment it quickly, and then you would distill it. And that was the basis for Lodi Scotch, which was brandy.
Oh, all right. Okay.
And then my grandparents were shippers of grapes and were involved with a winery that made brandy. And then my father, after the war, was general manager of Petri Winery, and that's where I grew up as a little kid. So that's a huge winery outside of Modesto, Petri. And I grew up there as a little kid. It's a much bigger facility now than it was as a kid, but very Italian focused at the time. And after we lived there for a decade and a half and stuff, I moved down to the Bay Area. I went to school at USC in Los Angeles to study architecture.
Oh.
I didn't graduate with that and moved to Davis. And I said I wasn't going to do what my dad did. And I took a course, Introduction to Wine for Americans, taught by the famous guy Maynard Amory, and instantly fell in love with it. And literally, I lasted at Davis another not quite 2 years and came over here to Napa Valley. And at that point, my dad was running Inglenook in Rutherford. So guess where my first job was. and then I was there for a harvest and then moved to Sterling Vineyards, which was a brand new winery. And all the stuff was at the bottom of the hill near Calistoga, and did that for a couple of years. And then we moved up to Amador County and I started Montevigna. And in the basement of our house when my wife and I were in our early 20s, sold that to Sutter Home. And then I went down to San Luis Obispo and started Corbett Canyon Vineyards.
Oh.
Which is different now than what it was then. And then I worked for like 15 years for Seagram, and I came back to Napa Valley, and I was president of Mum and Sterling and did that for 15 years. And then I left doing that. And since the late, like 98, I've started wineries and done winemaking and architecture for wineries here, Arizona, San Luis Obispo, Sonoma County.
Wow.
So, you know, it all fits into what I do. And then my son, Joel Gott, has his wine brand.
Oh my God. You know what? I did not put two and two together. Oh my God. Now I feel so stupid.
No, I did not. You've probably have been to one of our restaurants called God's Roadside here in St. Helena, San Francisco, Palo Alto.
Yeah, but remember, I'm more south, and I've been in Jersey for too long, but I will have to change that. Oh, my God. Did you actually see the light bulb go off above my head? Like, that did not go hand in hand in my brain at all.
That's you're not the first one that kind of like didn't put two and two together. It's no big deal.
See, but what's so interesting is that I joke that I stalk people who I interview so much. Like, I mean, I am looking all over the internet, and I don't think I saw that. I know I didn't see that connection anywhere because I would have put it together then. Oh, well. Okay. All right.
Wine's in the family.
Yes, yes. So you said that you grew up in there in the wine industry, but then you didn't think that was the industry you were going to go into. But
when I changed from USC to Davis, I said, you know, not knowing how old was I, 20 years old or 19 years old, I said, I'm not going to do what my dad does. You know, I don't know what I was talking about. And I wasn't really drinking wine at that point. You know, it was probably a beer once in a while. And I just took this course, Introduction to Wine for Americans, and I just fell in love with it.
Oh.
And that started. I mean, I never took my vision off the wine industry and growing grapes forever. I grow grapes now, and I make wine and run wineries and start wineries for people. It's just a lot of fun to do. It's, you know, sort of hold my hands, and I'll put you in the wine business. I'll keep you from making mistakes, but I want you to live your dream.
Right. That's awesome. You know, that's kind of like somebody that class is equivalent to your aha class, where, you know, some people are like, well, what's your aha wine? What's wine got you into loving wine? That's the class that you were like, yeah, this is what I definitely want to do.
Yeah.
You did or you didn't graduate from UC Davis?
No, I got close to the end and the harvest was coming. So I said, I'm coming back, and I never did. You know, so I probably had just a couple units to go. I don't remember the number. And I was all set up to go back. And Sterling came along and said, we want you to work for us. So go work.
Why do I need to graduate to get a job when I've got a job? All right. So you did mention it a little bit in there. So in addition to Calla Lily, you began your own business, Vineyard and Winery Estates. And
correct.
Copy this right from your mission statement. It provides specialized management services to select ultra-premium wine and vineyard estates. Our services range from startup efforts of new super-premium brands to evaluate and reshape existing winery and vineyard operations. We assist in property and brand searches for people who want to enter the vineyard and winery business. Due diligence on acquisitions is a specialty of our consulting services. So as you said, you basically hold people's hands and make sure they don't royally mess up to start their winery.
somebody that has come to me usually has the dream of getting into the wine business. I mean, that's the typical one. People who are doing it just on a business and they're going to take $5 million, invest in the wine business, and you know, we'll let it be its own self. I mean, that isn't as much fun. To spend the money, sure, but to get into the business and help them understand what is correct for what they want to do in a vineyard, what they want to do in a winery. Some people want to spend a massive fortune on the winery and have it, you know, everything polished, stainless steel, and unbelievable equipment. Or some people don't have the money to do that. You can make wine anywhere. A metal building with insulated walls and air conditioning is just as good as a huge, expensive winery that you build. So it really is. It's all vineyard. You know, it's the winemaking. The way I describe it is, it's 40% grapes, 10% winemaking, and fully 50% sales and marketing. That's what the wine business is. The grapes are important. I'm not trying to diminish what I do and only give myself 10% of the pie, but if I don't get good grapes, I'm not making good wine. So like at Calla Lily, we own the vineyard. I direct the farming. And the farming's not real complicated. I got a really good team, and we got good hands and equipment in the vineyard. And it's just make sure that we do it. We're growing grapes for quality. And then you got to figure out how to sell it and marketing. And some people are very good at marketing, and some people are not quite as good as others at marketing. So, but it's fun.
So the people who come to you, are they more into, or I guess it could be a mixture, are they more interested in learning to be the winemakers themselves, or are they more interested in, I want to own a winery, which is very different?
Well, I have a client that the person, great guy, really doesn't want to know winemaking. He's got the crude concepts, but that's not him. The guy's a natural salesman.
Oh.
And so he's really good at his great personality, really good at understanding how to sell stuff. I've had other people that thought they were really interested in winemaking, but they don't have the patience, and also growing grapes. You know, it doesn't happen. You know, you get up in the morning and nothing's growing there, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, there's grapes. You know, you got all these months, and you got to take vacation, you got to care for the vines, and you got to, you know, protect yourself and live life. And, you know, this time of year, I think it's very interesting for all of us because we switch as people. I did my vacation a couple weeks ago. I probably have this weekend off. And next week, probably not next week, but the following week, then the grapes start. And it'll go on till Thanksgiving. Well, yeah. Probably the last of the tanks will be dug out around Thanksgiving. Not that they have to be, but that's sort of the typical. So here comes the grapes, and we all sort of reinvent ourselves. Not you have to relearn winemaking, but you're kind of like, okay, so let's see, what did we do last year? And so, you know, we've got all our harvest supplies and the yeast, and all the barrels are arriving right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we changed any equipment, it's all been done by now. Or you're panicked that it's not done.
Right.
So look, for a lot of the people, there's multiple areas that they can get interested in. And some people are much more fascinated in the vineyards and sort of let the winery deal with the grapes. I have a client that one of the family members is really good at marketing, and she's just jumped in head over heels. She's not trying to learn winemaking. She's trying to help the brand move ahead. Her dad comes from software sales, and he's the kind of, he can learn anything. And so he's on my coattails, but he's not trying to be the winemaker. He's just trying to learn everything that's going on. And he's not a manipulator, but he's right in the middle of it, which is great. He comes, you know, it's like a tennis ball with a dog, you know, sort of waving at him. So that's, you know, they're all different. So, and I get to work with a bunch of wonderful people. And here in Napa Valley, just because this is where I live, you know, a third of the people here are in the business somehow related, all the Hispanics in the vineyard or in the winery. And then all the people, you know, right now at this time of year, we are just bringing on board interns. And, you know, a typical intern maybe has never worked in a winery before, or maybe one other place, a guy or a gal, some Chinese gals, the Chinese guys, Hispanics, you know, kids from South America, Europe, and they'll start working in mid-August, and they'll work till about Thanksgiving or December 1st. And they're pulling hoses and, you know, driving forklifts and pumping barrels and shoveling tanks out. It's great. And you end up at the end of it, they're not here yet, but black hands.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And they learn very quickly.
You've probably had the black hands.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And they learn very quickly that it's not really all glamour.
but it's
fun.
The camaraderie and stuff. The major thing is that you want to make sure that the winemaker who's actually running the place or the cellar master at least makes Monday night not a terrorism, so you can at least watch Monday night football.
There you go. There you go. There you go. And that in its own right in California is tough to do, because in Jersey, I'm starting at 8:30 at night. It's tough for me to fall, you know, to not fall asleep before the end of the game, and, you know, forget it if it goes into overtime. When we're here, it's like you got to rush home to start watching the game.
Exactly. There are simple things in life.
Yes, yes. And now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. All right, so I want to circle back to Calla Lily. How exactly did you meet Anthony Fung and Andy Choi.
So they were interested in investing in vineyard land and hopefully a winery in Napa Valley. Okay. And they had landed on a property that I wasn't involved when they selected it. And then I was brought in for due diligence on the property, and I told them, no, you're not buying this. You know, there's no reason to spend a lot of money on me when what you're to help them turn it into a winery when the vineyard was lousy and what was proposed to be a winery was not. I mean, it had nothing to do with a winery. No tanks, no nothing, and broken down equipment. That's not a winery. And water systems and wastewater systems that didn't work, and lousy wells, all the things. And I talked him out of it. I said, you're going to waste your money, and you're going to spend a lot of money here, and you're not going to get what you dreamed of in making quality wine. And at that time, that was 2012, I think, the property where the winery is had been built in, and the vineyard was older than the winery building, had been built in 2010, and then the owner of that, an older gent, accidentally crashed his airplane and was killed.
Oh.
So the family came in and just literally shut the winery down. And through friends in the technology and the vineyards and stuff here in Napa Valley, he said, you gotta have you taken a look at this winery over here on Pope Valley Road? And I hadn't. I'd ridden my bike by it many times, but it just never registered. And went and looked, and what the family had done, it has gone in and just basically turned the lights off. The wine was gone, no barrels, but all the equipment, there was still stuff in the refrigerator, and this was a couple of years later. I mean, it wasn't spoiled milk or something, but there was some beers and bags of ice in the refrigerator and stuff, and all the lab equipment was there. And I mean, the winery was literally walk in the door, turn the lights on, turn the refrigeration system back on, and away you go. So I changed out some of the equipment. We bought it. I changed out some of the equipment. The first year, we didn't use any of the grapes because I had to change the farming practices because they really weren't up to snuff of what I wanted them to be. And I brought in friends from a company called Crop Care and took over the viticultural direction from the vineyard manager that I had worked with for years. I'd known the guy for years. And the focus of the vineyard was growing lots of grapes and selling them at not very high prices. So we cut that out and turned the pressure down on the boiler and really turn the focus around, because good wood, no viruses, good rootstock, beautiful hillside, good water, and all we had to do is just improve the farming and the viticulture.
Tender, loving care.
It took us 2 years to be a success there. And in the middle of that, then we got into the winery, and we didn't try to operate it the first year because we weren't ready for it. I got rid of some tanks and put in more tanks. We had to buy barrels, put together a little staff, you know, a winemaking software, all the stuff we needed to do. And then the next year, boom, we're in business, 2012 and 2013. So
you had mentioned that just, you know, it was turn on the lights, perfect for them. What made you decide you wanted to be part of Calla Lily? Because I mean, I'm guessing that through the vineyard and winery estates, you have loads of people coming in, use your services, and then go off on their own. But with Calla Lily, you're in the heart of it.
Well, there's a lot of wineries here in the valley that I'm involved with. Four major wineries for Napa Valley here now that I make the wines at. And at that point, when they bought the property, there was probably one or two more, and a couple of them hadn't appeared yet. So in the case of Calla Lily, they asked me if I wanted to make the wines, because I was known for the wines I made at Round Pond and Ramsgate and D.R. Stevens and Pillar Rock, and, you know, go on down the list. And it wasn't all just winemaking. But working with architects, Calla Lily didn't need an architect. But I had done so many different things. They had read about me and what I did. And I, you know, again, hold my hands and I'll pull you into the wine business.
Awesome. How did you come up, or how did they come up with the name Calla Lily? Because it's actually one of my favorite flowers. And I did, in the blog post I wrote, I started off with the biologist in me, which is, I'm a trained biologist, microbiologist, I can't let it go that it's not a real lily. It's not a real lily, but it's Carolus linnaeus actually made a mistake when he was classifying it. And even though it was tried to be corrected later on, nobody stuck with it. They stuck with Calla Lily. So now that I got the science out of there, why Calla Lily?
Andy's wife's name in Chinese, Mandarin, translates to Calla Lily.
Oh.
Pretty simple.
Wow. All right.
Because people typically have an agonizing time naming a wine brand.
Yes.
They stumble all over the place, and then they'll come up with something that is trademarked by somebody else. Well, throw that away, and you got to find something else. So that it was a family name.
Oh.
And it's pretty.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Wow. That was very simple. Okay. So you had mentioned already that audax is the Latin for bold and daring. What made you decide that did you taste that wine first, or did you have the name in your mind first and then say, I'm going to create this wine to fit that?
No, I didn't create the name. They did.
Okay. They
did. They created Calla Lily, and they wanted ultimate red Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir, and then they came up with a year and a half later with audax. Wow, that's kind of cool. And so our designer, Shanda Williams, oh great, I got it, I got the concept, you know. And she did a couple iterations, and you know, so we had a label that was not audacious, but it was a little bit of a tribute, what you tried to do to the people that, you know, that first started the wine business here in the valley. And we knew from the start that was our best wine, our small amount of the best we can do. And so that's really easy to concept in the winery. You know, okay, I got it. And, you know, we bottle it later. It ages longer in the barrel. It gets a little bit more French oak, new French oak. But, you know, it was always the wine that we blended first, after we let each of the year's lots settle down 9 months or something, because we're back actually just a couple days ago, we blended the 2018 Audax and the 2018 Ultimate Cabernet.
Okay.
So they're blended, they're put away. We'll top the barrels during harvest, but we won't do anything with those barrels until probably the first of the year, because they're done, SO2 is adjusted, the barrels are full, we have a beautiful room. It's a little stark, but we have a good air-conditioned, humidity-controlled room that we store all the barrels in. It's what you would want for, you know, it's not a palace, but it doesn't have to be a palace. It's a proper place to age the barrels. And so they're put away over there in the corner. So
I have a couple of questions that I ask all winemakers. Tell me about your first harvest that you were responsible for the wine. What was it? How much did you make? How nervous were you? Or you were like, yeah, I got this. Any issues?
So when we started Montevigna in Amador County, we moved up there in 71. I did the harvest at Sterling Vineyards in 71, and then we left. We moved up to Amador County. And so it's 72 and part of 73, well, all of 73 and part of 74. We sold most of the grapes to Christian Brothers. But we had all these beautiful blocks of vineyard, old vines that went anywhere from the youngest of the old vines were actually my age, so they would have been 25 years old, 24 years old, to the oldest, which were about 80-year-old vines. Some very steep hillside. They were all cross-cultivated, dry-farmed, no rootstock vines. And so for the very first vintage, we did 39.54 tons, there's your number, in the basement of my house. And we had this old, an Italian house, you know, it's had a half basement and then big, heavy construction and, you know, brick everywhere. And, you know, sitting in the middle of 80 acres of old Amador County Zinfandel. And so we put together poured concrete, put together the right amount of equipment outside to get a crusher and a press and some tanks. And then all the barrels were down in the basement. You had to bang the barrels down the stairs to get them into the basement. And we were low enough ceiling that we could only stack the barrels too high, which is just fine, and age the wine downstairs. And we crushed, I don't remember the date, but we crushed the first of the grapes in September, and we wanted to make carbonic maceration Zinfandel, the wine that makes Beaujolais, right? And so I came up with a technique through a good friend of mine, Daryl Cordy, and reading about the production of Beaujolais. Not hard to understand. You put whole grapes in the tank, they juice. I did one step further. I definitely added yeast that I knew what was going to ferment. And so you do the carbonic maceration where all the fermentation takes place inside of each little berry, and it's a very different flavor and texture. And pressed, got the wine to go through malolactic, bottled probably the 13th of November. You know, this is the year we crushed the grapes. And sold my first cases to Cordy Brothers in Sacramento on the old traditional date of when Beaujolais was released to Paris on November the 15th.
Wow!
That wine was called Zinfandel Nuevo.
Wow! That's awesome. Okay, so
I was making money. Yeah.
That's like unheard of.
We had revenue coming in within just a few months after crushing grapes.
Well, that's a huge success. You can't ask for more than that. Wow. Wow.
First harvest.
That really wasn't that long ago, but what have you seen in terms of change in winemaking processes or in the wine industry since you started your career in it?
Well, starting with the vineyards, you know, it's much more specific on even though drippers and emitters and all irrigation existed, but, you know, like the original old vines in Montevideo didn't have any kind of irrigation. I mean, they were dry farm. You know, you had no way to get water to them. You almost never do a vineyard now without irrigation, which makes sense because you can then really control the vines. We have all these rootstocks that we work with now that are, you know, they're great. And when I was a kid, there was only two rootstocks. There's AXR1 and St. George. There were a few other ones, but the phylloxera problem caused a lot more rootstocks to become available. And then there's clonal selection of the varieties. So there's probably 15 clones of Cabernet you can get your hands on right now. A lot of them had viruses, so the university went through a lot of effort to clean up the viruses in all these various grapes. We had suitcase selections of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay come from Europe. They were pretty dirty virus-wise, but they got cleaned up. I love the Swan clone and the Calera clone, and both of those come from somewhere in Burgundy. I don't know what it really is. They make stunning Pinot Noir. They make Pinot Noir what Pinot Noir should be. So in the vineyard, we've gone from much narrower spacing, more vines per acre, a little bit more mechanical work to the vineyards, a lot less working the soils real hard, a lot more compost going back into the vineyard, and a lot more items that we add to the soil that are natural bacteria, mitochondria that are part of what goes back in the soil to make the soil healthy. So the vineyards we've definitely improved, but I think the sad thing about the vineyard is it shows what we're doing to the climate. So when I was a kid, the first vineyard I planted in Amador County, we planted Sauvignon Blanc. big healthy vines. Yes, they were not on rootstock, but they wouldn't have really changed the harvest date. Guaranteed, we would not pick Sauvignon Blanc until the Monday or Tuesday of the second week or the third week in September. So that'd be the 16th would be the typical day. I bet you they're picking Sauvignon Blanc in Amador County probably starting next week.
Yeah, wow.
That's climate change. And we see it totally here in Napa Valley. I mean, we don't have frost like what we used to. It's warmer. I mean, anybody says there isn't a climate change, and is it just due to man? I'm not going there. I think that we're an effect to it. I definitely think we're effect to it, but we would definitely see climate change. So those are things I see in the video. From the winemaking point of view, there's a lot more technical equipment that's out there. We never knew. Very sort of, what the heck was that? Never, you know, caves. Nobody had caves. And we dug some of the first caves here in Napa Valley. There were caves in Europe, you know, of course, for years. A lot more use of French oak and oak from around the world. It doesn't have to be French. Hungarian oak is great. So there was a lot more barrels involved, stainless steel barrels, and there was no such thing as that we had as a kid. Much better destemmers. Much better presses. So all of the technical stuff that we put our hands on to get the work done, it's all generational better. You know, my 55 Chevy drove really good, but the 2020 Chevy is better. I mean, that's a lousy analogy. But, you know, it's all improved along the way. You know, I have great software that helps us with winemaking. The software is not making the wine. The software is behind us, keeping track of the records. And if you could see my desk here, it's just littered with papers because I'm the guy, the kind of guy that doesn't know how to file anything. We have a lot more yeast. You know, I'm ordering yeast right now that we use in winemaking. I've settled on a couple that I really like, but in the catalogs that I order yeast out of, there's hundreds of yeast. And there's probably 20 different firms that make them. So they're good. You know, but I think we need a yeast that can take you. We're making higher alcohol wines that can take higher alcohol, really don't change the style of the wine, and some Vianus yeast that I like to add as a small part of the blend of yeast, and they're sort of the cleanup crew at the end, because Vianus will finish off the rest of the yeast. Malolactic was always something that was natural. Now we just have bags of malolactic, expensive, that we pour into the wine, and boom, it's done. We're used less SO2 than we have in the past. The winemaking techniques, I mean, there's biodynamic. I've done it. It's not what I do at any of the wineries now. We're trying to be really here. It's called Napa Green, which is definitely sustainable. I don't know that really changes a lot in the winery. It definitely changes some of the practices in the vineyard. I don't think the vineyards have to be organic. Some people do. It's what somebody wants to do. But when you're Napa Green and sustainable, you are 99.9% organic anyway. It's the final tenth that something happens and you need a spray to kill an infest of bugs or something, whatever. Right. So, but I would rather be sustainable. Bottling equipment is vastly better. You know, when I was a kid, there was no such thing as mobile bottling lines. Now half of the traffic on the road here in St. Helena is mobile bottling lines this time of year.
Yeah.
Packaging has changed a lot. You know, there's several times that screw caps have come in and out of our life, and now they're back in a big way. A lot of different bottles we can use. So the packaging has changed, but it hasn't changed dramatically. We're still basically putting the bulk of wine in glass bottles or in some box for the bulk of the wines. Canned wine, I'm not going to say yay or nay. It's not my, I mean, I'm, you know, the glass of wine that Vicky and I have with dinner tonight is not coming out of the can. I'm not trying to be rude about it. You know, I mean, we have a whole set of consumers that cans are just fine. So.
All right. So I have a long time ago, I read an article that stated that winemakers, you know, there is the saying that it takes a lot of good beer to make great wine. And in the article, they mentioned that most winemakers drink IPA. And Mike and I laughed hysterically because that is what we drink. Like, we enjoy IPAs. So I always ask that question to the winemakers also. Do you drink beer when you're not drinking wine?
Yeah, and I like Heineken. So at our restaurants, we sell a lot of beer, and then the staff that chooses the beer always has a lot of great selections. I know my guys and one of the wineries I work with, when they go to our restaurant, they're all into Sculpin, you know. So, but as a kid, and here's a story. So as a kid up in Amador County, you would buy, can't see it, but boxes of Budweiser bottles, long neck, right? And then if you knew how to read the Budweiser label, you could tell where it was brewed. And
oh,
so it yes. would be all the breweries. It'd be Fort Lauderdale, and there'd be St. Louis and Los Angeles and maybe someplace in Texas. I mean, maybe there was
Elizabeth, New Jersey. Don't forget Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Okay, so when there wasn't really hot, you'd get a case of that beer and it'd be from L.A. because that was close, right? But as it got hot in California, the brewery had a tough time staying up with demand. The big battleground brewery was the one in St. Louis. So somewhere like in August, the beer would start coming from St. Louis, because it would list all, and the name that first appeared of all the breweries is where it was brewed. And so Budweiser from St. Louis was so much better than I mean, we were probably talking ourselves into that, but we were men among men when the St. Louis beer came in.
There you go. So Mike and I went to St. Louis, and you can't go there without visiting the Budweiser facility, because that's the main, you know, and that's where all the Clydesdales are, and I love them. And I have to honestly say, I don't drink Budweiser, I don't drink Bud Light or whatever, but we drank it there, and I got to agree, it was stellar beer. There was something very different about that beer.
Yeah, no, it's Bud, you know, and you get I guess it was 24 in a pack, and you buy three or four of those at a time and throw them in the refrigerator, and you handed them out like candy, because at the end of the day, we were trash. All these modern beers didn't exist.
Right.
There was Budweiser, and there was Coors, and there was Olympia, and Schlitz, and Lucky, and, you know, what else were there?
Schaefer.
And that. Jack's from New Orleans.
All right. Before we wrap up, I just want to ask, did I miss anything that you want to talk about, or anything about Calla Lily, or about your business itself that I missed?
No, you know, I mean, you covered my business. This is great. You know, what I do is help people get into the wine business, and I work around a lot of really great clients, and the people that are actually working for me are working in the wineries. You need to take care of those. And so one of the keys to this at the wineries, because most of the wine, except one or two of them, are custom crush wineries.
Oh.
And going way back for many years, my wife has this chocolate bundt cake thing that, you know, chocolate with chocolate, and then, by the way, dump a little bit more chocolate in it.
Yum, yum, yum.
Vicky gets up every morning and makes it, and then, so I'm there walking into the winery with one or two of them, depending on the size of the coup. They're still warm. You can ask anybody to jump off a building or do anything you want, and they'll do it, because if Vicky shows up at any of the wineries, the cellar crew cheers. Well, that's one of them. So, you know, it's a family business. My son definitely takes care of his employees and stuff. His business is much bigger, but, you know, it's a family business, and it's really fun. It's not as easy as it looks. There's a lot of romance to it. Mm-hmm. But if you do it, I mean, you've got your own winery. If you do it and you do it with a love and passion, it's great, and it changes. You know, I mean, for years I ran Mum Napa Valley, and you know, that's a whole different world.
Right.
The French are very particular about blending and what they do. I did a tasting today at a winery called Rack and Riddle that I've done business with in the past, and they have massive operation, and you go in and you can choose wines that are just barely entourage,
right.
So they're done, and choose, and you put your own label
on it.
Wines were great to taste. I just love, and then there's this massive 250-foot long disgorging line. It's all the equipment. I love winery equipment. And just watching all of this equipment from all around the world take bottles, freeze the neck, disgorge it, dose it, stir the bottles, wash them, label them, package them, and cases pop out the other end on one line. It's amazing.
It's a beautiful thing.
I love the business.
That's awesome. That's awesome. As I end every Dracena Wines on Wine, I do a game of opposites with my guest. And basically, there's no right or wrong answer. Basically, I just say two different things, and you just say whichever one resonates with you more. And it came from a Friends episode with Phoebe and Joey. Joey wanted to go north or south, and she played this game, and I always thought it was a fun game. So are you up for playing like a 1 minute game?
Sure, yeah.
All right. No, you don't. There's no right or wrong answer, and there's no real thinking really necessary. All right. We'll start off with non-wine terms, and then we'll go to wine terms. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Night or day?
Day.
Sunset or sunrise?
Sunrise.
Black or white?
White.
Walk or run?
Run.
Food or drink?
Food.
Old world, new world?
Old world.
Sweet or dry?
Dry.
Bubbles or still?
Oh, bubbles. The best winemaker in the world that ever was Dom Perignon.
okay. Oak or stainless?
Oak.
Drink now, drink later.
Drink now.
Blend or varietal?
Blend.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage.
Cork or screw cap?
Screw cap.
Okay. Napa or Sonoma?
No, I make wine in both counties, but, you know, I'm more here, so Napa.
No, okay. Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous.
Bordeaux or Rhone?
Rhone.
And warm climate, cool climate?
Cool climate.
There you go. That's it.
Great.
So it's funny because it's also a little psychology thing. Most people, and you did do the whole thing, so like you started off with day, and then you stayed with that in the psychology realm because you went with sunrise and you went with white. So that kind of stays good. So it's always kind of interesting. And, you know, every podcast needs a little shtick to make it their own. So.
And so is the painting behind your head old?
Is it old? It is. It is. It is Poppy's. It was my grandfather. I called him Poppy, and he was my world. And so when he passed, I got that and a nice tattoo of a poppy.
So even though it's very different because it's Poppy's, my great-grandmother Daisy's Carey painting in my dressing room is that. I mean, it's the grape varieties. You know, it's different. Oh. I mean, it has nothing to do with Poppy's, but it's the same setting tribute to whatever was there. So it's a good setting for you with the, because the Poppy's are coming out
in my head. Yes, it is very near and dear to me. Very near and dear to me. I would love to see that photo. Maybe you can take a picture of it and send it.
Oh, sure.
Send it to me. I would love to see that photo.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Enjoy your day. Enjoy your probably last week before hell breaks loose and you don't get a rest until like Thanksgiving, right?
It's not hell. It's just, you know, you sort of gather up all the people that you work with and all the vines. And we move towards a couple months later, it's over.
Right.
And it's fun along the way.
It is. And when you're in it, you're in it. And then when it's over, you're like, all right, we're good.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And have a great night. Enjoy your wine, whatever you're opening tonight.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, sláinte.